at me, then put down her pencil. "Hello, young lady," she said, then took a deep breath. "What can I do for you?" I think I turned away so I didn't have to look at her, or at the papers over the desk. I can't remember if I said very much, if I explained about the noise and how I'd worried about it being gas. In any case, there was no proper conversation. She didn't want me there, and neither did I. I think I made some apology and went out, half expecting her to call me back. But she didn't. And what I remember now is that I went down the staircase burning with shame and resentment. At that moment, I wished more than anything that I hadn't seen what I'd just seen. Though if you'd asked me to define just what I was so upset about, I wouldn't have been able to explain. Shame, as I say, had a lot to do with it. And also fury, though not exactly at Miss Lucy herself. I was very confused, and that's probably why I didn't say anything about it to my friends until much later. After that morning, I became convinced something else, perhaps something awful, lay around the corner to do with Miss Lucy, and I kept my eyes and ears open for it. But the days passed, and I heard nothing. What I didn't know at the time was that something pretty significant had happened only a few days after I'd seen her in room 22. Something between Miss Lucy and Tommy that had left him upset and disorientated. There would have been a time not so much earlier when Tommy and I would have immediately reported to each other any news of this sort. But just around that summer, various things were going on which meant we weren't talking so freely. That's why I didn't hear about it for so long. Afterwards, I could have kicked myself for not guessing, for not seeking Tommy out and getting it out of him. But, as I've said, there was a lot going on around then, between Tommy and Ruth, a whole host of other stuff, and I'd put all the changes I'd noticed in him down to that. It's probably going too far to say Tommy's whole act fell apart that summer, but there were times when I got seriously worried he was turning back into the awkward and changeable figure from several years before. Once, for instance, a few of us were going back from the pavilion towards the dorm huts, and found ourselves walking behind Tommy and a couple of other boys. They were just a few paces ahead, and all of them, Tommy included, looked to be in good form, laughing and shoving each other. In fact, I'd say Laura, who was walking beside me, took her cue from the way the boys were larking about. The thing was, Tommy must have been sitting on the ground earlier, because there was a sizable chunk of mud stuck on his rugby shirt near the small of his back. He was obviously unaware of it, and I don't think his friends had seen it either, or they'd surely have made something of it. Anyway, Laura, being Laura, shouted out something like, "Tommy, you got poo-poo on your back. What have you been doing?" She'd done this in a completely friendly way, and if some of the rest of us made a few noises too, it wasn't anything more than the sort of thing students did the whole time. So it was a complete shock when Tommy came to a dead halt, wheeled round, and stared at Laura with a face like thunder. We all stopped too, the boys looking as bewildered as we were, and for a few seconds I thought Tommy was going to blow for the first time in years. But then he abruptly stalked off, leaving us all swapping looks and shrugging. Nearly as bad was the time I showed him Patricia C.'s calendar. Patricia was 2 years below us, but everyone was in awe of her drawing skills, and her stuff was always sought after at the art exchanges. I'd been particularly pleased with the calendar, which I'd managed to get at the last exchange, because word had been going round about it from weeks before. It wasn't anything like, say, Miss Emily's flappy colour calendars of the English counties. Patricia's calendar was tiny and dumpy, and for each month there was a stunning little pencil sketch of a scene from Hailsham life. I wish I still had it now, especially since in some of the pictures, like the ones for June and for September, you can make out the faces of particular students and guardians. It's one of the things I lost when I left the cottages, when my mind was elsewhere and I wasn't being so careful what I took with me. But I'll come to all that in its place. My point now is that Patricia's calendar was a real catch. I was proud of it, and that's why I wanted to show it to Tommy. I'd spotted him standing in the late afternoon sunshine beside the big sycamore near the south playing field, and since my calendar was there in my bag, I'd been showing it off during our music lesson, I'd gone over to him. He was absorbed in a football match involving some younger boys over in the next field, and at this stage his mood seemed just fine, tranquil even. He smiled when I came up to him and we chatted for a minute about nothing in particular. Then I said, "Tommy, look what I managed to get." I didn't try to keep the triumph out of my voice, and I may even have gone, "Ta-da!" as I brought it out and handed it to him. When he took the calendar, there was still a smile on his features, but as he flicked through, I could see something closing off inside him. "That Patricia," I began to say, but I could hear my own voice changing. "She's so clever." But Tommy was already handing it back to me. Then, without another word, he marched past me off towards the main house. This last incident should have given me a clue. If I'd thought about it with half a brain, I should have guessed Tommy's recent moods had something to do with Miss Lucy and his old problems about being creative. But with everything else going on just at that time, I didn't, as I say, think in these terms at all. I suppose I must have assumed those old problems had been left behind with our early teen years, and that only the big issues that now loomed so large could possibly preoccupy any of us. So what had been going on? Well, for a start, Ruth and Tommy had had a serious bust-up. They'd been a couple for about 6 months by then. At least, that's how long they'd been public about it, walking around with arms around each other, that kind of thing. They were respected as a couple because they weren't show-offs. Some others, Sylvia B. and Roger D., for example, could get stomach-churning, and you had to give them a chorus of vomiting noises just to keep them in order. But Ruth and Tommy never did anything gross in front of people, and if sometimes they cuddled or whatever, it felt like they were genuinely doing it for each other, not for an audience. Looking back now, I can see we were pretty confused about this whole area around sex. That's hardly surprising, I suppose, given we were barely 16. But what added to the confusion, I can see it more clearly now, was the fact that the guardians were themselves confused. On the one hand, we had, say, Miss Emily's talks, when she'd tell us how important it was not to be ashamed of our bodies, to respect our physical needs, how sex was a very beautiful gift, as long as both people really wanted it. But when it came down to it, the guardians made it more or less impossible for any of us actually to do much without breaking rules. We couldn't visit the boys' dorms after 9 o'clock. They couldn't visit ours. The classrooms were all officially out of bounds in the evenings, as were the areas behind the sheds and the pavilion. And you didn't want to do it in the fields, even when it was warm enough, because you'd almost certainly discover afterwards you'd had an audience watching from the house passing around binoculars. In other words, for all the talk of sex being beautiful, we had the distinct impression we'd be in trouble if the guardians caught us at it. I say this, but the only real case I personally knew of like that was when Jenny C. and Rob D. got interrupted in room 14. They were doing it after lunch, right there over one of the desks, and Mr. Jack had come in to get something. According to Jenny, Mr. Jack had turned red and gone right out again, but they'd been put off and had stopped. They'd more or less dressed themselves when Mr. Jack came back, just as though for the first time, and pretended to be surprised and shocked.
"It's very clear to me what you've been doing, and it's not appropriate," he'd said, and told them both to go and see Miss Emily.
But once they'd got to Miss Emily's office, she'd told them she was on her way to an important meeting and didn't have time to talk to them.
"But you know you shouldn't have been doing whatever you were doing, and I don't expect you'll do it again," she'd said, before rushing out with her folders.
Gay sex, incidentally, was something we were even more confused about. For some reason we called it umbrella sex. If you fancied someone your own sex, you were an umbrella. I don't know how it was where you were, but at Hailsham, we definitely weren't at all kind towards any signs of gay stuff. The boys especially could do the cruelest things. According to Ruth, this was because quite a few of them had done things with each other when they'd been younger, before they'd realized what they were doing. So now they were ridiculously tense about it. I don't know if she was right, but for sure accusing someone of getting all umbrella could easily end in a fight. When we discussed all these things, as we did endlessly back then,
we couldn't decide whether or not the Guardians wanted us to have sex or not. Some people thought they did, but that we kept trying to do it at all the wrong times. Hannah had the theory that it was their duty to make us have sex, because otherwise we wouldn't be good donors later on. According to her, things like your kidneys and pancreas didn't work properly unless you kept having sex. Someone else said what we had to remember was that the Guardians were normals. That's why they were so odd about it. For them, sex was for when you wanted babies, and even though they knew intellectually that we couldn't have babies, they still felt uneasy about us doing it, because deep down they couldn't quite believe we wouldn't end up with babies. Annette B. had another theory, that the Guardians were uncomfortable about us having sex with each other, because they'd then want to have sex with us. Mr. Chris in particular, she said, looked at us girls in that way. Laura said that what Annette really meant was that she wanted to have sex with Mr. Chris. We all cracked up at this because the idea of having sex with Mr. Chris seemed absurd as well as completely sick-making. The theory I think came closest was the one put forward by Ruth. They're telling us about sex for after we leave Hailsham, she said. They want us to do it properly, with someone we like and without getting diseases, but they really mean it for after we leave. They don't want us doing it here because it's too much hassle for them. My guess, anyway, is that there wasn't nearly as much sex going on as people made out. A lot of snogging and touching up, maybe, and couples hinting they were having proper sex. But looking back, I wonder how much of it there really was. If everyone who claimed to be doing it really had been, then that's all you'd have seen when you walked about Hailsham, couples going at it left, right and centre. What I remember is that there was this discreet agreement among us all not to quiz each other too much about our claims. If, say, Hannah rolled her eyes when you were discussing another girl and murmured, "Virgin," meaning, "Of course we're not, but she is, so what can you expect?" then it definitely wasn't on to ask her, "Who did you do it with? When? Where?" No, you just nodded knowingly. It was like there was some parallel universe we all vanished off to where we had all this sex. I must have seen at the time how all these claims being made around me didn't add up. All the same, as that summer approached, I began to feel more and more the odd one out. In a way, sex had got like being creative had been a few years earlier. It felt like if you hadn't done it yet, you ought to, and quickly. And in my case, the whole thing was made more complicated by the fact that two of the girls I was closest to definitely had done it. Laura with Rob D., even though they'd never been a proper couple, and Ruth with Tommy. For all that, I'd been holding it off for ages, repeating to myself Miss Emily's advice, "If you can't find someone with whom you truly wish to share this experience, then don't." But around the spring of the year I'm talking about now, I started to think I wouldn't mind having sex with a boy. Not just to see what it was like, but also because it occurred to me I needed to get familiar with sex, and it would be just as well to practice first with a boy I didn't care about too much. Then, later on, if I was with someone special, I'd have more chance of doing everything right. What I mean is, if Miss Emily was correct and sex was this really big deal between people, then I didn't want to be doing it for the first time when it was really important how well it went. So I had my eye on Harry C. I chose him for a number of reasons. First, I knew he'd definitely done it before, with Sharon D. Next, I didn't fancy him that much, but I certainly didn't find him sick-making. Also, he was quiet and decent, so unlikely to go round gossiping afterwards if it was a complete disaster. And he'd hinted a few times he'd like to have sex with me. Okay, a lot of the boys were making flirty noises in those days, but it was clear by then what was a real proposition and what was the usual boy stuff. So I'd chosen Harry, and I only delayed those couple of months because I wanted to make sure I'd be all right physically. Miss Emily had told us it could be painful and a big failure if you didn't get wet enough, and this was my one real worry. It wasn't being ripped apart down there, which we often joked about, and was the secret fear of quite a few girls. I kept thinking, as long as I got wet quick enough, there'd be no problem, and I did it a lot on my own just to make sure.
I realize this may sound like I was getting obsessive, but I remember I also spent a lot of time re-reading passages from books where people had sex, going over the lines again and again, trying to tease out clues. The trouble was, the books we had at Hailsham weren't at all helpful. We had a lot of 19th-century stuff by Thomas Hardy and people like that, which was more or less useless. Some modern books, by people like Edna O'Brien and Margaret Drabble, had some sex in them, but it wasn't ever very clear what was happening, because the authors always assumed you'd already had a lot of sex before, and there was no need to go into details. So I was having a frustrating time with the books, and the videos weren't much better. We'd got a video player in the billiards room a couple of years earlier, and by that spring had built up quite a good collection of movies. A lot of them had sex in them, but most scenes would end just as the sex was starting up, or else you'd only see their faces and their backs. And when there was a useful scene, it was difficult to see it more than fleetingly because there were usually 20 others in the room watching with you. We'd evolved this system where we called for particular favourite scenes to be played again, like, for instance, the moment the American jumps over the barbed wire on his bike in The Great Escape. There'd be a chant of, "Rewind, rewind," until someone got the remote, and we'd see the portion again, sometimes 3, 4 times. But I could hardly, by myself, start shouting for rewinds just to see sex scenes again. So I kept delaying, week by week, while I went on preparing, until the summer came, and I decided I was as ready as I'd ever be. By then I was even feeling reasonably confident about it, and began dropping hints to Harry. Everything was going fine and according to plan, when Ruth and Tommy split up, and it all got confused. Chapter 9. What happened was that a few days after they split, I was in the art room with some other girls working on a still life. I remember it being stifling that day, even though we had the fan rattling behind us. We were using charcoal, and because someone had commandeered all the easels, we were having to work with our boards propped up on our laps. I was sitting beside Cynthia E., and we'd just been chatting and complaining about the heat. Then somehow we'd got onto the subject of boys, and she'd said, not looking up from her work, "And Tommy, I knew it wouldn't last with Ruth. Well, I suppose you're the natural successor." She'd said it in a throwaway manner, but Cynthia was a perceptive person, and the fact that she wasn't part of our group just gave her remark more weight. What I mean is, I couldn't help thinking she represented what anyone with any distance on the subject would think. After all, I'd been Tommy's friend for years until all this couple stuff had come up. It was perfectly possible that to someone on the outside, I'd look like Ruth's natural successor. I just let it go, though, and Cynthia, who wasn't trying to make any big point, said nothing else about it. Then, maybe a day or two later, I was coming out of the pavilion with Hannah, when she suddenly nudged me and nodded towards a group of boys over on the north playing field. "Look," she said quietly. "Tommy, sitting by himself." I shrugged as though to say, "So what?" And that's all there was to it. But afterwards I found myself thinking a lot about it. Maybe all Hannah had meant to do was point out how Tommy, since splitting with Ruth, looked a bit of a spare part. But I couldn't quite buy this. I knew Hannah too well. The way she'd nudged me and lowered her voice had made it all too obvious she too was expressing some assumption, probably doing the rounds, about me being the natural successor. All this did, as I say, put me in a bit of confusion, because until then I'd been all set on my Harry plan. In fact, looking back now, I'm sure I would have had sex with Harry if it hadn't been for this natural successor business. I'd had it all sorted, and my preparations had gone well, and I still think Harry was a good choice for that stage in my life. I think he would have been considerate and gentle, and have understood what I was wanting from him. I saw Harry fleetingly a couple of years ago at the recovery centre in Wiltshire. He was being brought in after a donation. I wasn't in the best of moods because my own donor had just completed the night before. No one was blaming me for that. It had been a particularly untidy operation, but I wasn't feeling great all the same. I'd been up most of the night sorting all the arrangements,
and I was in the front reception getting ready to leave when I saw Harry coming in. He was in a wheelchair, because he was so weak, I found out later, not because he couldn't actually walk, and I'm not sure he recognized me when I went up and said hello. I suppose there's no reason I should have any special place in his memory. We'd never had much to do with each other apart from that one time. To him, if he remembered me at all, I'd just be this daft girl who came up to him once, asked if he wanted sex, then backed off. He must have been pretty mature for his age, because he didn't get annoyed or go round telling people I was a tease or any of that. So when I saw him being brought in that day, I felt grateful to him and wished I was his carer. I looked about, but whoever was his carer wasn't even around. The orderlies were impatient to get him to his room, so I didn't talk with him long. I just said hello, that I hoped he'd feel better soon, and he smiled tiredly. When I mentioned Hailsham, he did a thumbs up, but I could tell he didn't recognize me. Maybe later, when he wasn't so tired, or when the medication wasn't so strong, he'd have tried to place me and remembered. Anyway, I was talking about back then, about how after Ruth and Tommy split, all my plans got confused. Looking at it now, I feel a bit sorry for Harry. After all the hints I'd been dropping the previous week, there I was, suddenly whispering stuff to put him off. I suppose I must have assumed he was raring to go, that I had my work cut out just to hold him off. Because whenever I saw him, I'd always get something in quick, then rush off before he could say anything back. It was only much later, when I thought about it, it occurred to me he might not have had sex on his mind at all. For all I know, he might have been happy to forget the whole thing, except that every time he saw me, along a corridor or in the grounds, I'd come up and whisper some excuse why I didn't want sex with him just then. It must have looked pretty daft from his side, and if he hadn't been such a decent type, I'd have been a laughing stock in no time. Well, anyway, this era of putting Harry off lasted maybe a couple of weeks, and then came Ruth's request. That summer, right up until the warm weather faded, we developed this odd way of listening to music together in the fields. Walkmans had started appearing at Hailsham since the previous year's sales, and by that summer there were at least six of them in circulation. The craze was for several people to sit on the grass around a single Walkman, passing the headset around. Okay, it sounds a stupid way to listen to music, but it created a really good feeling. You listened for maybe 20 seconds, took off the headset, passed it on. After a while, provided you kept the same tape going over and over, it was surprising how close it was to having heard all of it by yourself. As I say, the craze really took off that summer, and during the lunch breaks you'd see all these clusters of students lying about the grass around the Walkmans. The guardians weren't too keen, saying we'd spread ear infections, but they let us carry on. I can't remember that last summer without thinking about those afternoons around the Walkmans. Someone would wander up and ask, "What's the sound?" And if they liked the answer, they'd sit down on the grass and wait their turn. There was almost always a good atmosphere around these sessions, and I don't remember anyone being refused a share of the headset. Anyway, that's what I was up to with a few other girls when Ruth came up to ask if we could have a talk. I could tell it was something important, so I left my other friends, and the two of us walked off, all the way to our dorm hut. When we got to our room, I sat down on Ruth's bed, close to the window. The sun had warmed the blanket, and she sat on mine over by the back wall. There was a blue bottle buzzing around, and for a minute we had a laugh playing blue bottle tennis, throwing our hands about to make the demented creature go from one to the other of us. Then it found its way out of the window, and Ruth said, "I want me and Tommy to get back together again. Kathy, will you help?" Then she asked, "What's the matter?" "Nothing. I was just a bit surprised after what's happened. Of course I'll help. I haven't told anybody else about wanting to get back with Tommy. Not even Hannah. You're the only one I trust. What do you want me to do?" "Just talk to him. You've always had this way with him. He'll listen to you. And he'll know you're not bullshitting about me." For a moment we sat there swinging our feet under our beds. "It's really good you're telling me this," I said eventually. I probably am the best person, talking to Tommy and all that. What I want is for us to make a fresh start. We're about evens now. We've both done daft things to hurt each other, but it's enough now. Martha, bloody H, I ask you. Maybe he did it just to give me a good laugh. Well, you can tell him he succeeded and the scores are all even again. It's time we grew up and started afresh. I know you can reason with him, Kathy. You'll deal with it the best way possible. Then if he's still not prepared to be sensible, I'll know there's no point carrying on with him. I shrugged. As you say, Tommy and I, we've always been able to talk. Yeah, and he really respects you. I know because he's often talked about it. How you've got guts and how you always do what you say you're going to do. He told me once if he was in a corner, he'd rather have you backing him than any of the boys. She did a quick laugh. Now you've got to admit that's a real compliment. So you see, it's got to be you to our rescue. Tommy and I were made for each other and he'll listen to you. You'll do it for us, won't you, Kathy? I didn't say anything for a moment. Then I asked, Ruth, are you serious about Tommy? I mean, if I do persuade him and you get back together, you won't hurt him again. Ruth gave an impatient sigh. Of course I'm serious. We're adults now. Soon we'll be leaving Hailsham. It's not a game anymore. Okay, I'll talk to him. Like you say, we'll be leaving here soon. We can't afford to waste time. After that, I remember us sitting on those beds talking for some time. Ruth wanted to go over everything again and again. How stupid he was being, why they were really suited to each other, how differently they'd do things next time round, how they'd keep much more private, how they'd have sex in better places at better times. We talked about it all and she wanted my advice on everything. Then, at one point, I was looking out of the window towards the hills in the distance, when I was startled to feel Ruth, suddenly beside me, squeeze my shoulders. Kathy, I knew we could depend on you, she said. Tommy's right. You're just the person to have when you're in a corner. What with one thing and another, I didn't get a chance to talk to Tommy for the next few days. Then, one lunchtime, I spotted him on the edge of the south playing field, practicing with his football. He'd been having a kickabout earlier with two other boys, but now he was alone, juggling the ball about in the air. I went over and sat down on the grass behind him, putting my back against a fence post. This couldn't have been long after that time I'd shown him Patricia C.'s calendar, and he'd marched off, because I remember we weren't sure how we stood with each other. He went on with his ball juggling, scowling with concentration, knee, foot, head, foot, while I sat there picking away at clovers and gazing at the woods in the distance that we'd once been so frightened of. In the end, I decided to break the deadlock and said, Tommy, let's talk now. There's something I want to talk to you about. As soon as I said this, he let the ball roll away and came to sit down beside me. It was typical of Tommy that once he knew I was willing to talk, there was suddenly no trace left of any sulkiness, just a kind of grateful eagerness that reminded me of the way we were back in the juniors when a guardian who'd been telling us off went back to being normal. He was panting a bit, and though I knew this was from the football, it added to his overall impression of eagerness. In other words, before we'd said anything, he'd already got my back up. Then when I said to him, Tommy, I can tell you haven't been too happy lately, he said, What do you mean? I'm perfectly happy. I really am. And he did a big beam followed by this hearty laugh. That was what did it. Years later, when I saw a shadow of it every now and then, I'd just smile. But back then it really used to get to me. If Tommy happened to say to you, I'm really upset about it, he'd have to put on a long, downcast face then and there to back up his words. I don't mean he did this ironically. He actually thought he'd be more convincing. So now, to prove he was happy, here he was, trying to sparkle with bonhomie. As I say, there would come a time when I'd think this was sweet, but that summer, all I could see was that it advertised what a child he still was, and how easily you could take advantage of him. I didn't know much then about the world that awaited us beyond Hailsham, but I'd guessed we'd need all our wits about us, and when Tommy did anything like this, I felt something close to panic. Until that afternoon, I'd always let it go. It always seemed too difficult to explain. But this time I burst out, saying, "Tommy, you look so stupid laughing like that. If you want to pretend you're happy, you don't do it that way. Just take it from me, you don't do it that way. You definitely don't. Look, you've got to grow up, and you've got to get yourself back on track. Everything's been falling apart for you just lately, and we both know why." Tommy was looking puzzled. When he was sure I'd finished, he said, "You're right. Things have been falling apart for me. But I don't see what you mean, Kath. What do you mean we both know? I don't see how you could know. I haven't told anyone. Obviously, I don't have all the details, but we all know about you splitting with Ruth." Tommy still looked puzzled. Finally, he did another little laugh. But this time it was a real one. "I see what you mean," he mumbled, then paused a moment to think something over. "To be honest, Kath," he said eventually, "that's not really what's bothering me. It's really something else altogether. I just keep thinking about it all the time, about Miss Lucy." And that was how I came to hear about it, about what had happened between Tommy and Miss Lucy at the start of that summer. Later, when I'd had time to think it over, I worked out it must have happened no more than a few days after the morning I'd seen Miss Lucy up in room 22, scrawling over her paperwork. And like I said, I felt like kicking myself I hadn't found out from him earlier. It had been in the afternoon near the dead hour, when the lessons were finished, but there was still some time to go until supper. Tommy had seen Miss Lucy coming out of the main house, her arms loaded with flip charts and box files, and because it looked like she'd drop something any moment, he'd run over and offered to help. "Well, she gave me a few things to carry and said we were headed back to her study with it all. Even between the two of us there was too much, and I dropped a couple of things on the way. Then, when we were coming up to the orangery, she suddenly stopped, and I thought she'd dropped something else. But she was looking at me, like this, straight in the face, all serious. Then she says we've got to have a talk, a good talk. I say fine, and so we go into the orangery, into her study, put all the stuff down. And she tells me to sit down, and I end up exactly where I was the last time, you know, that time years ago. And I can tell she's remembering that time as well, because she starts talking about it like it was only the day before. No explanations, nothing. She just starts off saying something like, 'Tommy, I made a mistake when I said what I did to you, and I should have put you right about it long before now. Then she's saying I should forget everything she told me before, that she'd done me a big disservice telling me not to worry about being creative, that the other guardians had been right all along, and there was no excuse for my art being so rubbish.' Hold on, Tommy. Did she actually say your art was rubbish? If it wasn't rubbish, it was something like it. Negligible. That might have been it. Or incompetent. She might as well have said rubbish. She said she was sorry she told me what she had the last time, because if she hadn't, I might have sorted it all by now.
What were you saying through all this?
I didn't know what to say. In the end, she actually asked. She said, 'Tommy, what are you thinking?' So I said I wasn't sure, but that she shouldn't worry either way because I was all right now. And she said, 'No, I wasn't all right. My art was rubbish, and that was partly her fault for telling me what she had.' And I said to her, 'But what does it matter? I'm all right now. No one laughs at me about that anymore.' But she keeps shaking her head, saying, 'It does matter. I shouldn't have said what I did.' So it occurs to me she's talking about later. You know, about after we leave here. So I say, 'But I'll be all right, miss. I'm really fit. I'll know how to look after myself. When it's time for donations, I'll be able to do it really well.' When I said this, she starts shaking her head, shaking it really hard, so I'm worried she'll get dizzy. Then she says, 'Listen, Tommy, your art, it is important. And not just because it's evidence, but for your own sake. You'll get a lot from it just for yourself.' Hold on. What did she mean? Evidence? I don't know. But she definitely said that. She said her art was important, and not just because it's evidence. God knows what she meant. I did actually ask her when she said that. I said I didn't understand what she was telling me. And was it something to do with Madame and her gallery? And she did a big sigh and said, Madame's gallery, yes, that's important. Much more important than I once thought, I see that now. Then she said, Look, there are all kinds of things you don't understand, Tommy, and I can't tell you about them. Things about Helsham, about your place in the wider world, all kinds of things. But perhaps one day you'll try and find out. They won't make it easy for you, but if you want to, really want to, you might find out. She started shaking her head again after that, though not as bad as before, and she says, But why should you be any different? The students who leave here, they never find out much. Why should you be any different? I didn't know what she was talking about, so I just said again, I'll be all right, miss. She was quiet for a time. Then she suddenly stood up and kind of bent over me and hugged me. Not in a sexy way. More like they used to when we were little. I just kept as still as possible. Then she stood back and said again she was sorry for what she told me before, and that it wasn't too late. I should start straight away making up the lost time. I don't think I said anything. She looked at me and I thought she'd hug me again. But instead she said, Just do it for my sake, Tommy. I told her I'd do my best, because by then I just wanted out of there. I was probably bright scarlet, what with her hugging me and everything. I mean, it's not the same, is it, now we've got bigger? Until this point I'd been so engrossed in Tommy's story, I'd forgotten my reason for having this talk with him. But this reference to our getting bigger reminded me of my original mission. Look, Tommy, I said. We'll have to talk this over carefully soon. It's really interesting, and I can see how it must have made you miserable. But either way, you're going to have to pull yourself together a bit more. We're going to be leaving here this summer. You've got to get yourself sorted again. And there's one thing you can straighten out right now. Ruth told me she's prepared to call it quits and have you get back with her again. I think that's a good chance for you. Don't mess it up. He was quiet for a few seconds, then said, I don't know, Kath. There are all these other things to think about. Tommy, just listen. You're really lucky. Of all the people here, you've got Ruth fancying you. After we leave, if you're with her, you won't have to worry. She's the best. You'll be fine so long as you're with her. She's saying she wants a fresh start, so don't blow it. I waited, but Tommy gave no response. And again I felt something like panic coming over me. I leaned forward and said, Look, you fool, you're not going to get many more chances. Don't you realize? We won't be here together like this much longer. To my surprise, Tommy's response, when it came, was calm and considered, the side of Tommy that was to emerge more and more in the years ahead. I do realize that, Kath. That's exactly why I can't rush back into it with Ruth. We've got to think about the next move really carefully. Then he sighed and looked right at me. Like you say, Kath, we're going to be leaving here soon. It's not like a game anymore. We've got to think carefully. I was suddenly lost for what to say, and just sat there tugging away at the clovers. I could feel his eyes on me, but I didn't look up. We might have gone on that way for a while longer, except we were interrupted. I think the boys he'd been playing football with earlier came back, or maybe it was some students strolling by who came and sat down with us. Anyway, our little heart-to-heart was at an end, and I came away feeling I hadn't done what I'd set out to do, that I'd somehow let Ruth down. I never got to assess what kind of impact my talk with Tommy had had, because it was the very next day the news broke. It was midway through the morning, and we'd been in yet another culture briefing. These were classes where we had to role-play various people we'd find out there, waiters in cafes, policemen, and so on. The sessions always got us excited and worried all at the same time, so we were pretty keyed up anyway. Then, at the end of the lesson, as we were filing out, Charlotte F. came rushing into the room, and the news about Miss Lucy leaving Hailsham spread through us in an instant. Mr. Chris, who'd been taking the class, and who must have known all along, shuffled off guiltily before we could ask him anything. At first we weren't sure if Charlotte was just reporting a rumour, but the more she told us, the clearer it became this was for real. Earlier in the morning, one of the other senior classes had gone into room 12, expecting music appreciation with Miss Lucy. But Miss Emily had been there instead, and she told them Miss Lucy couldn't come just at that moment, so she would take the class. For the next 20 minutes or so, everything had gone quite normally. Then suddenly, right in mid-sentence apparently, Miss Emily had broken off from talking about Beethoven and announced that Miss Lucy had left Hailsham and wouldn't be returning. That class had finished several minutes early. Miss Emily had rushed off with a preoccupied frown, and the word had started to go round as soon as the students had come out. I immediately set off to look for Tommy, because I desperately wanted him to hear it first from me. But when I stepped into the courtyard, I saw I was too late. There was Tommy, over on the far side, on the edge of a circle of boys, nodding to what was being said. The other boys were animated, maybe excited even, but Tommy's eyes looked empty. That very evening Tommy and Ruth got back together again, and I remember Ruth finding me a few days later to thank me for sorting it all out so well. I told her I probably hadn't helped much, but she was having none of that. I was most definitely in her good books, and that was more or less the way things stayed throughout our last days at Hailsham. Part 2. Chapter 10. Sometimes I'll be driving on a long, weaving road across marshland, or maybe past rows of furrowed fields, the sky big and grey and never changing mile after mile, and I find I'm thinking about my essay, the one I was supposed to be writing back then, when we were at the cottages. The guardians had talked to us about our essays on and off throughout that last summer, trying to help each of us choose a topic that would absorb us properly for anything up to 2 years. But somehow, maybe we could see something in the guardians' manner, no one really believed the essays were that important, and among ourselves we hardly discussed the matter. I remember when I went in to tell Miss Emily my chosen topic was Victorian novels. I hadn't really thought about it much, and I could see she knew it. But she just gave me one of her searching stares and said nothing more. Once we got to the cottages, though, the essays took on a new importance. In our first days there, and for some of us a lot longer, it was like we were each clinging to our essay, this last task from Hailsham, like it was a farewell gift from the guardians. Over time, they would fade from our minds, but for a while those essays helped keep us afloat in our new surroundings. When I think about my essay today, what I do is go over it in some detail. I may think of a completely new approach I could have taken, or about different writers and books I could have focused on. I might be having coffee in a service station, staring at the motorway through the big windows, and my essay will pop into my head for no reason. Then I quite enjoy sitting there, going through it all again. Just lately, I've even toyed with the idea of going back and working on it, once I'm not a carer anymore and I've got the time. But in the end, I suppose I'm not really serious about it. It's just a bit of nostalgia to pass the time. I think about the essay the same way I might a rounders match at Hailsham I did particularly well in, or else an argument from long ago where I can now think of all the clever things I should have said. It's at that sort of level. Daydream stuff. But as I say, that's not how it was when we first got to the cottages. 8 of us who left Hailsham that summer ended up at the cottages. Others went to the White Mansion in the Welsh Hills, or to Poplar Farm in Dorset. We didn't know then that all these places had only the most tenuous links with Hailsham. We arrived at the cottages expecting a version of Hailsham for older students, and I suppose that was the way we continued to see them for some time. We certainly didn't think much about our lives beyond the cottages, or about who ran them, or how they fitted into the larger world. None of us thought like that in those days. The cottages were the remains of a farm that had gone out of business years before. There was an old farmhouse, and around it, barns, outhouses, stables all converted for us to live in. There were other buildings, usually the outlying ones, that were virtually falling down, which we couldn't use for much, but for which we felt in some vague way responsible, mainly on account of Keffers. He was this grumpy old guy who turned up 2 or 3 times a week in his muddy van to look the place over. He didn't like to talk to us much, and the way he went round sighing and shaking his head disgustedly implied we weren't doing nearly enough to keep the place up. But it was never clear what more he wanted us to do. He'd shown us a list of chores when we'd first arrived, and the students who were already there, the veterans, as Hannah called them, had long since worked out a rota which we kept to conscientiously. There really wasn't much else we could do, other than report leaking gutters and mop up after floods. The old farmhouse, the heart of the cottages, had a number of fireplaces where we could burn the split logs stacked in the outer barns. Otherwise we had to make do with big boxy heaters. The problem with these was they worked on gas canisters, and unless it was really cold, Keffers wouldn't bring many in. We kept asking him to leave a big supply with us, but he'd shake his head gloomily, like we were bound to use them up frivolously or else cause an explosion. So I remember a lot of the time, outside the summer months, being chilly. You went around with 2, even 3 jumpers on, and your jeans felt cold and stiff. We sometimes kept our Wellingtons on the whole day, leaving trails of mud and damp through the rooms. Keffers, observing this, would again shake his head, but when we asked him what else we were supposed to do, the floors being in the state they were, he'd make no reply. I'm making it sound pretty bad, but none of us minded the discomforts one bit. It was all part of the excitement of being at the cottages. If we were honest, though, particularly near the beginning, most of us would have admitted missing the guardians. A few of us, for a time, even tried to think of Keffers as a sort of guardian, but he was having none of it. You went up to greet him when he arrived in his van, and he'd stare at you like you were mad. But this was one thing we'd been told over and over, that after Hailsham there'd be no more guardians, so we'd have to look after each other. And by and large, I'd say Hailsham prepared us well on that score. Most of the students I was close to at Hailsham ended up at the cottages that summer. Cynthia E., the girl who'd said about me being Ruth's natural successor that time in the art room, I wouldn't have minded her, but she went to Dorset with the rest of her crowd. And Harry, the boy I'd nearly had sex with, I heard he went to Wales. But all our gang had stayed together, and if we ever missed the others, we could tell ourselves there was nothing stopping us going to visit them. For all our map lessons with Miss Emily, we had no real idea at that point about distances and how easy or hard it was to visit a particular place. We'd talk about getting lifts from the veterans when they were going on their trips, or else how in time we'd learn to drive ourselves, and then we'd be able to see them whenever we pleased. Of course, in practice, especially during the first months, we rarely stepped beyond the confines of the cottages. We didn't even walk about the surrounding countryside or wander into the nearby village. I don't think we were afraid exactly. We all knew no one would stop us if we wandered off, provided we were back by the day and the time we entered into Keffer's ledger book. That summer we arrived, we were constantly seeing veterans packing their bags and rucksacks and going off for 2 or 3 days at a time with what seemed to us scary nonchalance. We'd watched them with astonishment, wondering if by the following summer we'd be doing the same. Of course we were, but in those early days it didn't seem possible. You have to remember that until that point, we'd never been beyond the grounds of Hailsham, and we were just bewildered. If you told me then that within a year I'd not only develop a habit of taking long, solitary walks, but that I'd start learning to drive a car, I'd have thought you were mad. Even Ruth looked daunted that sunny day the minibus dropped us in front of the farmhouse, circled round the little pond, and disappeared up the slope. We could see hills in the distance that reminded us of the ones in the distance at Hailsham, but they seemed to us oddly crooked, like when you draw a picture of a friend and it's almost right but not quite, and the face on the sheet gives you the creeps. But at least it was the summer, not the way the cottages would get a few months on, with all the puddles frozen over and the rough ground frosted bone hard. The place looked beautiful and cosy, with overgrown grass everywhere, a novelty to us. We stood together in a huddle, the eight of us, and watched Keffers go in and out of the farmhouse, expecting him to address us at any moment. But he didn't, and all we could catch was the odd, irritated mutter about the students who already lived there. Once, as he went to get something from his van, he gave us a moody glance, then returned to the farmhouse and closed the door behind him. Before too long, though, the veterans, who'd been having a bit of fun watching us being pathetic, we were to do much the same the following summer, came out and took us in hand. In fact, looking back, I see they really went out of their way helping us settle in. Even so, those first weeks were strange, and we were glad we had each other. We'd always move about together, and seemed to spend large parts of the day awkwardly standing outside the farmhouse, not knowing what else to do. It's funny now, recalling the way it was at the beginning, because when I think of those 2 years at the cottages, that scared, bewildered start doesn't seem to go with any of the rest of it. If someone mentions the cottages today, I think of easy-going days, drifting in and out of each other's rooms, the languid way the afternoon would fold into evening, then into night. I think of my pile of old paperbacks, their pages gone wobbly, like they'd once belonged to the sea. I think about how I read them, lying on my front in the grass on warm afternoons, my hair, which I was growing long then, always falling across my vision. I think about the mornings waking up in my room at the top of the black barn, to the voices of students outside in the field, arguing about poetry or philosophy. Or the long winters, the breakfasts in steamed-up kitchens, meandering discussions around the table about Kafka or Picasso. It was always stuff like that at breakfast. Never who you'd had sex with the night before, or why Larry and Helen weren't talking to each other anymore. But then again, when I think about it, there's a sense in which that picture of us on that first day, huddled together in front of the farmhouse, isn't so incongruous after all. Because maybe, in a way, we didn't leave it behind nearly as much as we might once have thought. Because somewhere underneath, a part of us stayed like that, fearful of the world around us, and, no matter how much we despised ourselves for it, unable quite to let each other go. The veterans, who of course knew nothing about the history of Tommy and Ruth's relationship, treated them as a long-established couple, and this seemed to please Ruth no end. For the first weeks after we arrived, she made a big deal of it, always putting her arm around Tommy, sometimes snogging him in the corner of a room while other people were still about. Well, this kind of thing might have been fine at Hailsham, but looked immature at the cottages. The veteran couples never did anything showy in public, going about in a sensible sort of way, like a mother and father might do in a normal family. There was, incidentally, something I noticed about these veteran couples at the cottages, something Ruth, for all her close study of them, failed to spot, and this was how so many of their mannerisms were copied from the television. It first came to me watching this couple, Susie and Greg, probably the older students at the cottages, and generally thought to be in charge of the place. There was this particular thing Susie did whenever Greg set off on one of his speeches about Proust or whoever. She'd smile at the rest of us, roll her eyes and mouth very emphatically, but only just audibly, "God help us." Television at Hailsham had been pretty restricted, and at the cottages too, though there was nothing to stop us watching all day, no one was very keen on it. But there was an old set in the farmhouse and another in the black barn, and I'd watch every now and then. That's how I realized that this "God help us" stuff came from an American series, one of those with an audience laughing along at everything anyone said or did. There was a character, a large woman who lived next door to the main characters, who did exactly what Susie did. So when her husband went off on a big spiel, the audience would be waiting for her to roll her eyes and say, "God help us," so they could burst out with this huge laugh. Once I'd spotted this, I began to notice all kinds of other things the veteran couples had taken from TV programs. The way they gestured to each other, sat together on sofas, even the way they argued and stormed out of rooms. Anyway, my point is, it wasn't long before Ruth realized the way she'd been carrying on with Tommy was all wrong for the cottages, and she set about changing how they did things in front of people. There was in particular this one gesture Ruth picked up from the veterans. Back at Hailsham, if a couple were parting, even for a few minutes, it had been an excuse for big embraces and snogging. At the cottages, though, when a couple were saying goodbye to each other, there'd be hardly any words, never mind embraces or kisses. Instead, you slapped your partner's arm near the elbow, lightly with the back of your knuckles, the way you might do to attract someone's attention. Usually the girl did it to the boy, just as they were moving apart. This custom had faded out by the winter, but when we arrived it was what was going on, and Ruth was soon doing it to Tommy. Mind you, at first Tommy didn't have a clue what was going on, and would turn abruptly to Ruth and go, "What?" so that she'd have to glare furiously at him, like they were in a play and he'd forgotten his lines. I suppose she eventually had a word with him, because after a week or so they were managing to do it right, more or less exactly like the veteran couples. I'd not actually seen the slap on the elbow on the television, but I was pretty sure that's where the idea had come from, and just as sure Ruth hadn't realized it. That was why, that afternoon I was reading Daniel Deronda on the grass, and Ruth was being irritating, I decided it was time someone pointed it out to her. It was nearly autumn, and starting to get chilly. The veterans were spending more time indoors, and generally going back to whatever routines they'd had before the summer. But those of us who'd arrived from Hailsham kept sitting outside on the uncut grass, wanting to keep going for as long as possible the only routine we'd got used to. Even so, by that particular afternoon, there were maybe only three or four apart from me reading in the field, and since I'd gone out of my way to find a quiet corner to myself, I'm pretty sure what happened between me and Ruth wasn't overheard. I was lying on a piece of old tarpaulin, reading, as I say, Daniel Deronda, when Ruth came wandering over and sat down beside me. She studied the cover of my book and nodded to herself. Then, after about a minute, just as I knew she would, she began to outline to me the plot of Daniel Deronda. Until that point I'd been in a perfectly okay mood, and had been pleased to see Ruth, but now I was irritated. She'd done this to me a couple of times before, and I'd seen her doing it to others. For one thing, there was the manner she put on, a kind of nonchalant but sincere one, as though she expected people to be really grateful for her assistance. Okay, even at the time I was vaguely aware what was behind it. In those early months, we'd somehow developed this idea that how well you were settling in at the cottages, how well you were coping, was somehow reflected by how many books you'd read. It sounds odd, but there you are. It was just something that developed between us, the ones who'd arrived from Hailsham. The whole notion was kept deliberately hazy. In fact, it was pretty reminiscent of the way we'd dealt with sex at Hailsham. You could go around implying you'd read all kinds of things, nodding knowingly when someone mentioned, say, War and Peace, and the understanding was that no one would scrutinize your claim too rationally. You have to remember, since we'd been in each other's company constantly since arriving at the cottages, it wasn't possible for any of us to have read War and Peace without the rest noticing. But just like with the sex at Hailsham, there was an unspoken agreement to allow for a mysterious dimension where we went off and did all this reading. It was, as I say, a little game we all indulged in to some extent. Even so, it was Ruth who took it further than anyone else. She was the one always pretending to have finished anything anyone happened to be reading, and she was the only one with this notion that the way to demonstrate your superior reading was to go around telling people the plots of the novels they were in the middle of. That's why, when she started on Daniel Deronda, even though I'd not been enjoying it much, I closed the book,
sat up and said to her, completely out of the blue, "Ruth, I've been meaning to ask you, why do you always hit Tommy on the arm like that when you're saying goodbye? You know what I mean." Of course,